Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
The old order based on oil has now been overthrown, and I don't think it's ever going to be patched back together again.
Michael T. Clare joins us to talk about Libya, its people, and its oil. There are growing challenges to the Obama administration and other major world powers to take some kind of action, to say something, in response to the violence in Libya. There were gun battles in the industrial town of Al-Zawiya and other towns in the southwest of Libya. Opposition members now trying to find Gaddafi, whose loyalists are using force to try to hold on to territory, specifically Tripoli. Michael Clare has specialized in documenting the impact of resource wars on societies and on U.S. foreign and military policy. In January of 2011, he warned of a global food and energy crisis. Michael Clare is author of 13 books, including Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet, Blood and Oil, and Resource Wars, and a contributor to Harper's, Foreign Affairs, the Los Angeles Times, and defense analyst for The Nation magazine. He's also director of the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College in Amherst. Michael Clare, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
First, the Obama administration under pressure now to make policy on Libya. How much of U.S. policy interests are about oil versus the human lives at stake as Gaddafi, continues to try to hold on to power and rely more heavily on violence and an alleged mercenary force?
I think you have to distinguish between the immediate present, the next few weeks, in the long term. Over the long term, U.S. interests have always been about oil. In the immediate present, I think the concern is the lives of American citizens working in Libya and appearing to be on top of that situation, which doesn't look very good right now. I don't think the human rights of Libyan citizens have ever been a significant concern to the U.S. government, but there is an issue here of appearance of being in command in Washington. The U.S. leadership always seeks to give the impression of being in control of things in the world. That's essential to its image, and right now it appears to be losing control of the situation all over the Middle East, and I think that's what has people in Washington most concerned, how to demonstrate some aura of authority.
Well, and of course, this all was really starting to come to a head even as the president was meeting with people from the computer industry, the world of technology, to discuss what their technologies might mean for the U.S. economy, given the huge role that they've been playing on Wall Street. So he does have pressure on him to continue to see positive growth in the economy and, really continued success on Wall Street, I would say.
Well, of course. I think that this is a very critical time for President Obama and the Obama administration, particularly with all of the hostility he's getting from the Republican Party. He's got to demonstrate that he is in command, that he has a vision for the future, that he has a dynamic program. And now we're faced with a situation in the Middle East that nobody prepared for, nobody anticipated, that's sort of beyond control of American leadership, and that Washington is scrambling to keep on top of and is continually falling behind. So I think the issue here for Washington is to demonstrate some degree of authority, of being on top of things, and I think they're having a very hard time doing that.
Now, it's interesting that in some ways, U.S. and Libyan relations had been normalizing. I mean, this in a post-nuclear circumstance for Libya, which, originally Libya was defined as a rogue state, but the big concern was that they would get a nuclear warhead.
Yes, this was certainly so during the Reagan era into the first Bush administration and even into the second Bush administration. But the economic sanctions that the U.S. and the Europeans imposed on Libya following the Lockerbie plane crash did did damage Gaddafi's capacity. It did affect the Libyan economy. It did isolate him and hamper his ability to carry out the program he set for himself to be a leader of the Arab and African world. And he came to the conclusion at some point that he had to restore his ties to the West, and that required that he give up his nuclear weapons ambitions, which he did in 2003. And when he did so and agreed to pay reparations to the families of the Lockerbie victims, he was more or less embraced by the George W. Bush administration for the reason always of oil, because that opened the door for American oil companies to come back into Libya, where they had been banned since 1989, and they came rushing back in.
In a way, it's almost like a perfect storm when it comes to world oil pricing, because as you were writing just in January the 24th, you had a piece in Huffington Post where you talked about the high price of grains, of food, in the world market and what that will mean in terms of it being a crisis. But then, too, you know, the price of oil impacting all of this. So, you know, obviously you were not surprised that this has had the impact that it's had. But can you just talk about this kind of volatility and explain to us a little bit about how it works and, you know, what's at stake in terms of world oil?
Oh, well, we're talking about a very complex, large system of factors that, as you say, a perfect storm coming together at one moment in time. And this has been building for quite some time. And when I say a complex of factors, you have rising world population, you have globalization, which has ensnared all these countries into the global economy, but failed to deliver on the promises of bringing employment and growth to many of the countries we're talking about in North Africa and the Middle East. So you have millions and millions of young people without any jobs, without any job prospects, but facing higher and higher prices for food, for fuel, for heating oil, for the basic necessities of life. So they're trapped, these young people that we've seen in the streets, in a horrendous situation of rising prices and no prospects, no possibility of improving their lives. And I think that is the background to what we're seeing, and a sense of desperation and bitterness, resentment at the promises made by globalization and all of these regimes saying that things are going to get better when they're not getting better and prices are rising. So the earliest of the outbreaks occurred in December in Algeria, and they were food riots. And the outbreaks in Tunisia, the second wave, also were driven in large part by the rising price of food. Food is now twice as expensive as it was a year or so ago, especially staples like wheat and corn and sugar, the basic necessities of life. And if you're poor, this means that your ability to survive has been cut in half. And that's, I think, the backdrop for what we're seeing.
Now, all of this happening at a time when ethanol has been advertised as very green, has been incentivized by first the Bush-Cheney administration, Bush making his brother Jeb, you know, a kind of ethanol czar. But you've said that oil would have to be priced at roughly $50 to make it all worthwhile.
You can, as you say, incentivize ethanol by providing subsidies, and that's what we do in the United States through various legislation. But in a world market sense, once oil is above $50 a barrel, and it's been that way for quite some time, now it's $100 a barrel, it makes much more sense for a farmer to grow corn or whatever to make ethanol and to grow less food. And as a result, the supply of food is shrinking. The supply of ethanol is growing to profit from these rising prices of fuel. It's a catch-22 almost.
You've long actually been interested in the Middle East and Africa in terms of oil. And I'd like you to just talk about Libya as it's meaningful in context there. What does it mean that they're a large oil-producing nation? I mean, I know that They were once occupied by Italy. There are Italian oil interests at stake. But what about the U.S. interests, and what's the meaning of Libyan oil right now?
Libya is an important oil producer. It produces about 2% of the world's oil. Now, that's not a huge amount, but it's important in a double sense. It's important because right now the world thirst for oil is greater than ever before, and even 2% has a big impact on the world supply. If you take it away, then the world supply is going to contract enough to cause panic and push prices higher. But in addition to this, Libyan oil is especially sweet, meaning it has a very low sulfur content, meaning it's very easy to refine into distilled products like gasoline and diesel and jet fuel, whereas a lot of the oil that comes from, say, Venezuela or Saudi Arabia is what they call very sour. It has a lot of sulfur and other impurities, which means it's harder to refine, and not all the refineries, especially in Europe, are equipped to process that more sour fuel. So if you take away Libyan oil from the market, that's going to drive prices up much higher because it'll be harder, especially in Europe, to get the kind of clean-burning fuel that they need for cars and jet planes. And so Libya really is important. But this has to be said against the larger picture that we're at a moment in time in world history when the world supply of oil is simply not keeping pace with rising global demand. And many of us believe that we've reached a point of peak oil production where the world production simply cannot increase very much anymore. And therefore, every increase in demand stresses the supply even further, pushing up prices and creating greater stress in the whole world's economy. And that's where we are today.
It's been interesting. In the last month, there have been reports that the reserves were, you know, pretty much on track as far as the supply and demand situation of today.
You don't mean reserves. You mean spare capacity. That is the ability to increase production. The only spare capacity that exists in the world today are a few million barrels per day in Saudi Arabia. The Saudis could increase their production if they chose to. This is very sour crude containing a lot of sulfur that's very hard to refine. That's all that's left in the world of spare capacity, something that can be ramped up rapidly to meet an emergency. Nobody else in the world has any spare capacity that could be ramped up quickly, and there are no promising new supplies of oil anywhere in the world. The only new fields in development are offshore Brazil, but that's a decade away and very problematic. There's the oil in the deep waters of the Gulf of Mexico, but that's not going to happen very quickly given what we know. There just aren't any new fields beckoning out there to satisfy rising world demand. Meanwhile, all the world's existing fields are in freefall decline. So we're facing a future in which oil will be increasingly scarce.
I noticed in your writing about this part of the world, you've said, I believe it was rising powers, shrinking planet, the new geopolitics of energy. You've talked about the oil interests in Libya in what's called the elephant, you know, which is a large expansion of oil there. You know, I think you mentioned companies like Hess, maybe Occidental, Marathon Oil, ConocoPhillips, you know, all having big contracts at stake. And actually, in the last week, Gaddafi canceled those contracts, in effect, when he declared a circumstance of force majeure. So where are we? I mean, who would then step in to have, you know, persuasive capacity with Libya now, given that Gaddafi is under so much stress? I mean, could it be the U.S., the U.N., the IAEA? I mean, who?
I don't think there's anybody with the capacity to restore those fields to production. I think we should assume that they're now off the market for the indefinite future. Either Gaddafi will prevail in this battle, which I think is unlikely, and some degree of order will be restored, and the companies will come back. I don't think that's very likely. or some new government will arise, and over time that government will be able to restore confidence in Libya and the oil companies will come back. But I think we have to assume that Libya's production will be significantly reduced for the foreseeable future. And I can't imagine that the United States or any other country is going to invade Libya to get control of that oil. That's just not within the cards anymore. That is a recipe for utter chaos and self-destruction.
Now, there are calls for the Obama administration to take a stand on Libya. Certainly, the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, has spoken out against the tactics that we understand are in use there. It's hard to get real news out of Libya right now. But what we are getting tells us that mercenaries have been hired and that the general population is under attack, even as they continue to engage in a protest movement. So, I mean, the U.S. is being called upon to do something. And in a way, you know, all we have to go by is the history, which goes back to, you know, a lot of allegations that Gaddafi's crazy, that he's a global terrorist supplying mostly, you know, American enemies, let's say, with military supplies.
Mm-hmm. We're at a moment in time where the United States no longer has the ability to make things happen by its sheer will. I think President Obama will make some speeches, and Hillary Clinton will make some speeches, and the Security Council will issue some edicts. But I don't know that the United States possesses the capacity to do anything about any of this. We're in a world where America no longer, you know, has that sort of power that maybe it once did. In 2003, when the United States invaded Iraq, it could do things like that. But I think America's power to invade countries and solve problems through military force are over. We don't have the capacity any longer.
The military capacity, you're not, because you are also implying something about, you know, credibility and also whether or not we would find partners to work with us in policies given the recent history.
Yeah, well, there's many factors that would go into such a decision. I don't think we possess the military capacity to address the problem in Libya. Perhaps once Gaddafi is overthrown or killed or flees the country and there's chaos, there could be a multinational humanitarian mission to bring food and medical supplies to Libya that the United States could participate in. Now, the United States did impose economic sanctions on Libya over a 15-year period beginning in the late 1980s, but that took 15 years to have some effect. So imposing economic sanctions now are not going to have much of an effect. What I'm saying is that America's ability to affect what's happening on the ground in these very rapidly moving events is practically zero.
And Michael Clare, put this in the context that you brought to light in the book Blood and Oil and the documentary film about Blood and Oil, because it seems to me that some of the very same critical questions are being raised by what the United States is looking at in Libya right now and other countries where there are popular uprisings and there's oil in the background. You know, it's as if you've really set the example for a discussion of whether or not people matter as opposed to global resources.
Well, I think that is the right question to ask. I think the question here is to what degree all that we're seeing rests to some degree on the global oil economy and the political decisions that stem from that. I believe that ultimately the political equation that we saw in the Middle East was highly dependent on oil, that the United States favored regimes that were favorable to American oil interests, certainly in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. In Iran, the United States cooperated with the British in overthrowing the government of Mossadegh in 1953 and kept the Shah in power for 15 or so years. The United States has played a key role in keeping Mubarak in power because he was part of this larger structure of power in the region that facilitated American exploitation of Middle Eastern oil. Before that, it was the British that were largely responsible for creating this order. So I think oil has been the determining factor in setting the political system in the Middle East, and it was frozen in time with cooperating dictators, and the interests of the people were never respected in the region. And finally, and before our eyes, in the past month or so, the people of the region have said, enough of this. We're going to take matters into our own hands. So the old order based on oil has now been overthrown, and I don't think it's ever going to be patched back together again.
And when you say that, I mean, we're talking about a regional situation. Libya also more close to Africa, and so we're looking at oil trading, we're looking at oil transport, and we're looking at countries impacted by what happens to societies that might be on the run. As we know, the society in Libya is on the run. That could certainly impact, Italy. I mean, it could impact a lot of countries where refugee issues are at stake. We're seeing, again, perfect storm type scenarios unfolding before our eyes.
Yes, I mean, this is like a tsunami where the waves are spreading out, and we have no idea as yet where all those waves are going to land and what effects they're going to have. I don't think we've seen the end of it at all at this point, but I wouldn't predict what the outcome is going to be, except to say that I think we should assume that the age of oil is coming to an end, and we had better take steps to prepare for that fact. For example, Libya had been viewed as one of the great frontier areas for new development. In the offshore areas of Libya had never been developed, and two of the biggest oil companies in the world, Exxon and BP, have been planning in the past 2 years to invest billions of dollars to develop offshore Libya. And they were going to do this with Gaddafi. Recall that John Hayward, the famous president, CEO of BP, the man who was derided in the United States for his callous handling of the Deepwater Horizon incident, met with Gaddafi 2 years ago and signed a $800 million deal to begin drilling offshore. And Rex Tillerson, the president of Exxon, also met with Gaddafi and pledged to spend billions of dollars to develop offshore Libya. This is going to be part of the future of oil and gas. And I don't see that that's ever going to happen, or at least we cannot no longer assume that that will be the case.
The United States has long had interests in Egypt. Israel has interests in Egypt. Talk about the other countries now that we've seen in the news in the last couple of weeks. Tunisia, Egypt, Yemen, Lebanon, too, as well as Libya. I mean, what's the big picture here when it comes to U.S. policy? Regime change is one thing, in terms of one leader, but you're talking about a global system with both the economy at stake and also with military and geopolitical power structures in question.
Yes, I think we should take a look at Bahrain, which is a small country in terms of population and one that was more in the news until the revolt broke out in Libya. But Bahrain is still very much in play and matters a great deal. Bahrain is the headquarters of the U.S. Fifth Fleet, which is the naval force that was established in 1947 by President Truman for the explicit purpose of protecting America's access to the oil of the Persian Gulf area. It was the earliest expression of American reliance on Middle Eastern oil, and has been there since 1947, and is a key feature in America's use of military force to ensure access to the oil of the Middle East. And this is a country that's now facing the same kind of turmoil. Now, not saying that the base itself is at risk, but who knows what's going to happen there. And what's happening in Bahrain is important because of what it says about Saudi Arabia, the most important of all of the countries in the Middle East. Bahrain has a Shiite majority and a Sunni elite, and it's the Shiites who are protesting, claiming that they are being mistreated and abused by the Sunni elite. Right across a causeway from Bahrain lies the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, where all the oil comes from, which also has a Shiite majority. Now, the Sunnis in Saudi Arabia are the majority countrywide, and they certainly control the country. But in the oil-producing region, the Shiites are the majority. And if they rose up the way their brothers and sisters in Bahrain have done, then we're going to see much higher oil prices, I can assure you.
And of course, Bahrain could also catalyze events cross-border to an extent with Saudi Arabia, as have the people involved in the uprising in Egypt. They are fundraising for the people of Libya and have been sending aid in the form of convoys, you know, ground convoys.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently $30,000 raised in one day from a Facebook site that mentioned this need that the Libyan people have for food and to keep going with their uprising. So in the sense that you're talking about Bahrain and Saudi Arabia, we could see those kinds of alliances start to grow.
All of this is possible. A new world is being born by the hour. And like you say, it's involving new alliances at the popular level, bypassing the elites that have ruled all this time. And the elites have been most closely associated with the United States. So the old order that the United States relied on is vanishing before our eyes, and a new political order is arising. What form that will eventually take, we don't know, but it is one being created by popular forces, something we've never seen before.
Professor Michael T. Clare is a professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College. I want to ask you finally, Professor Clare, about the United Nations, the World Security Council. Who could, let's say, host a dialogue today about ways to foster peace in the region of the Middle East and North Africa? What bodies might be available? Can you make a suggestion here, finally?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I think that established governments have lost their legitimacy, so it would have to be non-governmental organizations, perhaps religious organizations, perhaps an alliance of Christian and Jewish and Muslim organizations, or people like Nobel Peace laureates. Governments have been discredited in all of this. So whatever arena, it has to be outside of that, outside of the world of governments.
Professor Clare, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Michael T. Clare directs the Five College Program in Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College in Amherst, Massachusetts. His latest book is Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet. His earlier book, Blood and Oil, is now available as a film from the Media Education Foundation. You can find recent articles at TomDispatch.com and Huffington Post, in addition to a wide variety of other major magazines, including The Nation. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut, and syndicated with Pacifica Network. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions. Our music is by Fritz Heed.